Lucky Broadcasting presents Don't Write Me Off.
Welcome, everybody, to the final episode of Season 2 of Don't Write Me Off. We're so fortunate to be here. You know, it's always a little bittersweet getting to the end of the road with one of these seasons. We're very excited to be recording this episode with our fantastic writers. Writers who delighted us, scared us, made us laugh, gasp, and brought the magic and mysticism that made this season possible. And as a reminder, those writers are Jacqueline Fant, Amber OK, Alex Knight, Emma J, Peyton Russell, and John Martin. Unfortunately, Robert Bobby Burns cannot be with us, but we have some words from him that we're excited to share with you all. We're also very excited to announce that season 2, we saw a huge jump in audience participation. We more than doubled the number of responses from season 1, so we're celebrating that today. Thank you all for being with us. Thank you, audience, for tuning in and for voting and for going along on this ride with us. Before we jump into questions that we prepared for each of you, we want to start with some general questions for the group. So I'm going to kick it over to Chase to ask those.
Hey, guys, so as the first general question to you all, what was your initial reaction to the prompt? And as a reminder to the audience, the season 2 prompt asks that each story include a mystic as the character, a resort as the location, and something is lost as the inciting incident. So what were your thoughts?
I thought it was a super fun prompt, you know, a great group of different items to include in a story. I thought it was really cool how each writer like incorporated it and made it their own. Particularly for me, the mystic is really interesting because I was already in that mind space of watching fantasy stories and kind of reading them as well. And I was, ooh, yeah, I can work with this. And, you know, how can we make this character not modern, but feel like ephemeral? So that was the fun part for me.
I had no idea what a mystic was, so I had a lot of research to do, and then I started to go down a rabbit hole of not knowing a lot of things, particularly alchemy. I, for some reason, was getting alchemy and mysticism mixed up, and I was really confused, but then I figured it out. It was fun to see everybody's interpretation of mystic, because it does seem to have a bit of a broad definition.
I similarly, Emma, did not know what a mystic was, so I had to look that up. Also, try to broaden my sense of what that word even meant. And then the resort prompt was really fun. I was trying to find something different than just a vacation on a resort. That took me into a rabbit hole of like, what other kind of resorts are there? What qualifies as a resort? It's just fun to broaden the scope of what I normally write about.
I had just seen White Lotus at the time, and so as soon as I saw resort, I was immediately thinking somewhere fancy, somewhere nice, somewhere tropical. I think it's all about a resort being like the nicest place around, and if you're at the bottom of a canyon, maybe the nicest place around is like a shack. So that's more the route I took it.
I love the White Lotus, so I was very excited to have a resort as part of the prompt. From the mystic character, I thought I could take a broad approach to that as well and kind of reinterpret it my own way. And then the something is lost, I thought was a really great inciting incident and go almost any direction with that. So I thought it was a really good mix of things that could cohesively work together. So that was exciting for me.
I thought that sounded like a prompt that Shanson would come up with the previous winner.
I felt like when we received the prompt, Chase and I had this conversation where we're like, what do you do with this? How do you tie all these together? We were really excited by what you all came up with. The directions that everyone went with, they were different. And it was amazing to see how each of you sort of processed those three elements.
I was excited because the last season, the character was a Quaker. I feel like that boxes you in a little bit in the mystic character. Not only is it sort of an identity, but along with that, start to introduce the supernatural element and maybe some sort of like powers that come along with the character. It's sort of like a three-dimensional choice there. All right, next general question for you all. Curious to know who amongst you were fans of audio dramas prior to this experience. And for those of you who maybe weren't familiar with audio dramas, has your opinion changed?
I was definitely a fan of audio dramas going into this. I mean, I listened to season 1 and that was really fun. I listened to other audio dramas like Full Body Chills, which where my actor Anthony Coons has narrated a few episodes of that. So that's a horror podcast. And I thought that was a really unique way to approach that genre from an audio perspective. And then I'm also a fan of the audio podcast Lord Serpent's Library, which is a comedy horror podcast. So I think that the audio space is really expanding, and to try to shift my perspective from visual storytelling storytelling to audio storytelling, I thought was a fun challenge. So I was excited to be part of season two.
I hadn't previously really listened to audio dramas. When I think audio drama, I think of, you know, back in the day when Orson Welles was scaring people, making them think about aliens and stuff, which I always loved that story. And then there's that episode of Hey Arnold. And I know it's really become a big thing, especially in the pandemic. And so I've definitely been wanting to get more into them. And I think Don't Write Me Off was a great way to get excited about them and kind of find out all the different creative things you could do with an audio drama. Like what John Martin was saying, especially the first season, just seeing the way everybody interpreted those different ideas so differently was super cool. So yeah, now I'm excited to check out more.
And Amber, you've had some experience writing for audio. I'm curious, just to sort of piggyback off of what you're saying, how did this experience differ, if at all?
Yeah. So in the previous audio drama formats that I've worked on, they were run similarly to a TV writer's room. So we basically had showrunners, producers, and then staff writers, and we would get together and meet weekly and break story and get an outline and go write the episode. So where the writer did have some creative input, there was already, you know, a story that was decided and you were given that, and then doing your thing with it, where this was like we had full creative control, and knowing that six other people were going to also have the same elements and interpret it differently was cool, because you're like, oh, I wonder what this person's going to do with this, and you know, how can I make mine different? So yeah, that was interesting to see how that all played out.
I listen to a lot of books on tape because of my commute. Then when I talked to you and Chase, and I listened to your guys' podcast. Also, when is that coming out? I want the next season of that. That was really, really good. The difference between an audiobook and a podcast is the dialogue changes a little bit to describe the world around. After listening to my episode, I was like, I probably should have done that even more. It felt like you're being a little bit, you're just too descriptive. But then when I re-listened to it, I was like, do people kind of, can they follow along with what I wrote? I think you guys did a great job adding the sound effects and everything, but if I'm gonna do it again, I think that's the lesson I learned about the audio format, is be as extra descriptive and maybe the editor can cut it out.
I felt similarly. I had never listened to a narrative podcast before. I only listened to regular podcasts where there's a host and they talk about a subject. And I noticed through this process just how much I rely on physical comedy. And it was really hard to not try to put in visual gags. And I was even just rereading my script this morning and seeing that even though I tried so hard to not put in visual gags, I wrote in a visual gag that clearly is not on the podcast. That's something if I were to do this again, just deepening that understanding of how to put basically it all in sound effects and dialogue, which was really difficult. And it's so impressive that everyone here was able to do it so seamlessly.
There is a big learning curve when doing this. Just to step back to what Emma was saying, when Chase and I started working in this space, I came to audio dramas with very similar experience as the rest of you working in the visual medium. And it was a huge challenge to sort of rewire my brain to think, how am I going to tell this story for a listening audience? Emma, thank you for the compliment, and because you set us up so nicely, we will use the opportunity for a very small plug to say that Original Kin is still being worked on. We have all of the outlines for all of the episodes, and we are scripting them right now.
As the final question to the group before we move on to individual questions, what surprised you the most about this experience? Maybe you go into it writing your script and then time has passed. Maybe you forgot a little bit about it. We produced it, you hear it. And how did that either change your perspective on how you thought it would turn out, or any other surprises along the way?
I was really pleasantly surprised how you all did so much with the sound effects and just the overall aural texture of the piece, and like a lot of things that I didn't even put in there, you and Cole added to just make the whole story work better and make it more cohesive, and then substitute for what's missing visually, because there's nothing to look at. So your ears have to do double the work and just kind of build this world for the listener. I think you guys nailed it when you did that.
100%. Yeah, that's what I was going to say too. I was just so impressed at how y'all were able to paint that picture through just the audio alone and just elevate all of our writing. Like, everybody's episode sounded so cool. And the amount of animals that were included in the episode, got dogs, goats, like chickens and full bazaars. I was like, that's so funny that kind of everybody put that in there. And you guys just made everything sound so realistic, and the audio itself with its own character in everybody's episodes.
Yeah, I'd love to know if you guys had a camera while you guys were doing the audio and just like walking around the room with a gong and like yodeling or whatever. Love to know what your guys' process was for that. Were you doing the ADR crunching lettuce together or whatever? What was that like?
I think I might have some Ring camera footage of me in my driveway just walking around with my Zoom microphone capturing footsteps. And if you were one of my neighbors, probably you're going, what is this weirdo doing in his driveway with his headphones on? And I'm just like locked in, carefully recording each step. But yeah, there's a lot of Foley work involved in these productions. And so from the top end of production, what we do is we create a Foley schedule of all the sounds that are required for each episode. And we go through and then make some notes. I notate what page it's on, assign IDs to them. A lot of the sound effects can also be just grabbed from premium subscription libraries that we can tap into, which makes things like getting horse sounds for Amber's episode. It's kind of a combined effort of those two strategies to make this come to life.
Chase did not have prior experience before season one with doing Foley work. And so for me, it's been really kind of magical to see how he's grown as sound engineer and a Foley artist himself. Every time I get a cut of the episodes, I'm just blown away because I'm with it through the writing process with you guys and directing all of the actors and hoping that these performances are going to splice together well. He finds the best takes and we have to dial things up and down here to there. And the way he's able to sort of onboard that and interpret it and make it happen, it's nothing short of a miracle.
I was also really surprised by how short 20 pages is. You know, it really forces you to tighten up your story and be very efficient, beginning, middle, and end in there. And so I thought that was a really good challenge for this season. And it really pushed me as a writer.
Thank you all for sharing those thoughtful responses, and thank you again for being a part of the season and sharing your talents with us. We now want to dig in a little bit more, questions specific to each of your stories. So going in order of the episodes, we'll start with Amber and the Merchant of Dawn. Amber, most writers are familiar with the seven basic plots of storytelling. For those listening who are unfamiliar, the names of each basic plot is telling of what you'd expect. They include overcoming the monster, rags to riches, voyage and return, comedy, tragedy, rebirth, and finally the one that would be assigned to the Merchant of Dawn, the quest. Now, oftentimes these stories are sprawling, taking the audience on a journey of many locations, meeting many supporting characters, and testing the protagonist's resolve again and again. The Lord of the Rings is a perfect example of the quest. Typically, a key signature of the quest is that we, the audience, learn of a deeper or hidden reason for the protagonist to go on said quest. But given the brevity of your story, we don't really come to realize or know what this quest means to Azima in that way. So we're curious if you were thinking about that while you were writing this story, and if you have a deeper meaning in mind for Azima, or are you doing a bit of self-reflection and having Azima chase something that maybe she doesn't entirely understand, i.e., do you feel like you're similarly on a quest as a writer that you haven't fully realized the deeper meaning of?
What an amazing layered question. Thank you. Yeah, I would say definitely when I was writing the episode and thinking of Azima's journey, and like you mentioned, we only have 20 pages or so to tell the whole complete story. And I do feel like the story maybe can be expanded because it is a quest. Those do tend to have lots of challenges and ups and downs. I think initially I did want it to be longer, but I ended up shortening it just because I ran out of time. So I was like, okay, how do I tell this story in an even shorter amount of time? But I think for me, the main theme of this was sacrifice. And I know a few different characters kind of ask Azima, like, what are you willing to lose in order to gain what you really want? And originally I intended for her to give away all three crystals on her journey to find the mystic and go through a couple more challenges in the resort, but she ends up getting to keep two of them. So I kind of love the idea of, you know, you gain these things that are supposed to be super valuable, but you have an end goal that you have to give them up because what's more important, this material thing or the end goal? And in terms of the deeper meaning, I think for Azima, she's a treasure hunter, so this was her piece to add to her collection. She's always chasing that next high, but these dice have eluded her for some time, so I think they were something that were really prized in her eye, not just like it's a shiny treasure. These are these things that are talked about to all treasure hunters, the people who study these mystical items, and she's like, I'm the one that's going to find them. And I do think it tied into my journey as a writer. I didn't think about it until you mentioned it. Yeah, now reflecting on it, especially these last few years, we've had a really tumultuous time in the industry, and it does feel like we're still recovering at the Wild West right now, and hopefully things are falling back into place, but it does feel like you have to be flexible and adaptable. And I think learning to write for the audio format has been a really fun way to kind of flex that creative muscle. And Peyton and Anna mentioned earlier in terms of just being able to rely on visuals and really have to like focus on the dialogue and paint that story for the listener has been a really fun challenge. And it kind of reminded me of comic writing a little bit too, where you're like, okay, we can't have long sentences. You have to be brief, but also get your point across. And especially if you're doing something that's supposed to be comedic tone, just being able to have that joke land, I think was the really cool thing to do.
What's the treasure for you? At the end of the day, if there is a treasure, what is that?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to be able to make a living off of writing and I think not have any restrictions. I've had to be adaptable since TV writing. I thought was like the original goal, but it's kind of maybe not been taken off the table, but kind of placed aside. Getting into comics and getting into audio dramas and I being able to write across those mediums and even children books as well. I can't draw, but I love working with illustrators and I think the collaborative nature of it. The end goal would be able to make a living off of writing for, you know, all these different mediums and being able to collaborate with other artists.
That's incredible. And knowing you as a writer and having read more than just The Merchant of Dawn, your writing is just so visual and the world building is so rich. So I can't wait to see what you do in the comic space. This is sort of a fun one, but what happened to the mystic to stop her from seeing a sunrise again? And should we assume that by passing a relic onto Azima, that Azima is somehow doomed to a similar fate?
Ooh, I love that. In my head, the reason she hasn't seen a sunrise for some time also ties into the, like, what are you willing to sacrifice? I think it was Emma earlier who was talking about when she was researching Styx and alchemy and all that and conflating the two, but there is a lot of crossover. And I find a lot of those traditional mystic characters, for example, if they're trying to turn a metal into gold, copper or something like that into gold, they kind of have to become reclusive and they really dig deep into their studies. And so that's what she was doing. She wasn't able to go out in the daytime. She sacrificed being able to see the sun. She's searching for this deeper meaning and trying to attain that next level of knowledge. I don't think Azima has been cursed with this because now she's moving on to the next thing, but that would be kind of a fun little sequel now because Azima has these dice. She has to, you know, go on this whole other journey.
I think that's great. And I hope that we get to see more of Azima because I do feel like you've created such a rich and vast world that this is easily adaptable to what you're talking about working in the comic space or something that's more long form. Mm-hmm. In reflecting on the episode, that struck me is that we don't really know if this is past, present, or future, because it could take place at any time. And I think that that's something that's really interesting about what you've created. You could do so many things with this world. It's not necessarily rooted in our reality, but it doesn't necessarily have to not be rooted in our reality too, right? Well, thank you for answering those questions. Chase, would you like to?
Yeah. All right. Next writer is Alex, who wrote Bright Angel. And one of the things that Cole and I find most rewarding about directing and producing these is when we hear from our writers about how we've captured their work in a way that they intended it to be. A big part of that process is understanding the tone of the story because it gives us the guardrails for the performances and things like music selections. What was fascinating about the production and post-production process of your episode is that Cole and I find ourselves returning time and time again to the question of what is the tone of this? And that's not made to be an insult. I think plenty of people would agree that storytellers like David Lange, M. Night, or Charlie Kaufman can seem a little tonally ambiguous. So I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on how you imagine the tone on the page versus what we heard in the final product. How close or far apart are they? And if there were any, what were the comps that you were thinking about when you wrote this?
I don't know if I'd go so far as to call it a comp because that's a little lofty, but I was really inspired by Canterbury Tales, just sort of how everyone's telling a story along a journey. And then also I have taken a hike out of the Grand Canyon. So like going from the bottom to the top is much harder than going from the top to the bottom. I think most of it is mental too. Every turn you go around, you see like you haven't made that much progress. And it's just the necessity of passing the time and keeping your mind on anything other than the miles of path ahead of you and the sheer drops on the left-hand side. And so what you all did was different than what I imagined. And I think that's a great thing because that's the beauty of collaboration. And I think we as writers in this contest are in a, like a position of privilege to be able to write something and then imagine it as certain way and then hand it off to you and say like these are the ingredients. It'll be great to see the audio omelet that you return and present to the world. It can be more than one way, and this is a very nice creative experience, even though we didn't work on it side by side, to have that sort of collaboration like one after the other. It was very fun.
If you had to pitch the rest of the story to a studio, who lives, who dies? Is there an order that they go? Give us a glimpse into the next two acts of the larger story, if there were one.
the way I viewed what we heard as an act three. And so maybe acts one and two in my mind are the different groups of people congregating separately on the rim of the canyon and then making their way down, experiencing their various conversations on the way down, and then being at the bottom, having the overnight, experiencing the pitch black and like how bright the stars can be down there, and then the hike back up. At that point, what we saw was them being done with traveling for the most part. And like the thing that they set out to do, they sort of accomplished. And then they still have the most rigorous and most mentally frustrating part of the journey ahead of them, which is getting out of the canyon. They would be much less jaded and I think a little more adventurous, and they probably wouldn't get eaten.
You have to give me who died
first.
I hate to say, but probably the baby, probably the easiest target. You know, it's an appetizer.
Oh, that's cruel.
That's nature, man. That's the after credit scene.
I want to respond to what you pitched us as your sort of three-act structure. What I find interesting about sort of what you're laying out in a fuller version of this story, what I think is somewhat of like a thriller suspense or a psychological thriller, to go through the laborious act of hiking the Grand Canyon, be it down and or up, but also having to do it with all of these very specific personalities. I've kind of conjured this idea of them wearing on each other over time, and then it building toward this literal horror that is bred from all of the psychological terror that they're experiencing in the moment. I think that that's such a fascinating concept. Emma, we're going to move on to you now and Mystical Wedding, and perhaps maybe Zelda will have some input here as well. Donald is clearly dealing with a form of identity crisis, maybe called imposter syndrome. Is there any part of yourself that's been injected into Donald's personal struggles? I think a lot of young writers would want to know if you struggle with imposter syndrome, like so many of the rest of us. And if so, how do you address that?
I'm clearly a mom. It was so crazy because I was writing on a show during the pandemic, and then the next show I got was a script coordinator job, but I felt like this is still a stepping stone towards being on a staff. And then the strike happened. That was right after I had my first baby. And so I was very much like at home as a mom for almost 1.5 years. Now I'm back in a writer's room as a script coordinator. I feel like I am a writer, but a lot of times my heart is at home, just balancing this new identity as a mom, and especially to young children. In my head, I keep thinking when they're in middle school and they don't even want to hang out with me, then I'll 100% be a writer. And I do feel like I'm a writer, but especially with two kids and working, it's been really hard to be writing. So I guess I do identify with that a little bit. I am surprised you didn't think of me as the main character who's like super cool and like an influencer and everybody just thinks she's so beautiful and talented. But thanks for saying I'm Donald. That's really nice. View.
Emma, we already know that about you. We were looking to go a little bit deeper. Just wanted to go a little bit deeper with your
work. No, I think of my husband as Donald, obviously.
This is very true. And I know your husband well. And yeah. Listeners might not know is that your husband is Turkish and there are Turkish elements to this story. So were you drawing on inspiration there as well with your own wedding?
Well, when I looked up mystic, Whirling Dervish is a mystic. Of course, there's like different kinds of mystics. But yeah, Whirling Dervish is famously Turkish. Just thought it was funny to include them in a wedding ceremony because they do wear a long white dress and it would make the bride really mad.
That's great. I love that you snuck in another mystic. You did double the work to get another one in there. Well, thank you for that answer. Now, for a more fun, relatable question, I guess. The people want to know, and by the people, I mean myself, Chase, my father-in-law, and Nadia, who voiced the character. Have you envisioned a series with Janine as the central character?
So I went to Hofstra University as a freshman in Long Island, New York, and I took a yoga class there. This woman had the exact same voice as Janine, and it was like, Shavasana, relax, screaming at people in her Long Island accent to like be mindful and relax. And she's like, you're doing it wrong. And I'm like, okay, this is like not LA yoga at all, but I love it. And that just like never came out of my head, of that experience of being like, okay, college is really stressful. I'm going to center myself myself. I'm going to do this. And then there's just this Long Island accent screaming at me to like relax and close my eyes. So totally. I feel like a Janine character, like somebody who's just no bullshit, get stuff done, but it's in this environment of like, relax, be yourself, find your true self. She is kind of her true self. She's just not in a relaxing way.
I can assure you we have a verbal contract from Nadia that once you've broken
the story, she was so good.
She's ready to jump on. We love working with Nadia. We love working with all of our actors, all of our voice talent, John and Peyton included, who voiced roles in their own episodes. We're actually going to move on to Bobby, but unfortunately Bobby is unable to join us today. So Chase, Bobby has written to us some of his answers.
So Bobby wrote The Mystic and the Hillbilly, and our question is, write what you know. We hear that a lot, especially when you're first becoming writers. What I know about you is that you're from Florida and you have been a barista through whether the two overlapped, I'm unsure. While I don't think you've ever been a mystic, I'm curious to know who you identify most with in this story. To that end, what is the catharsis of writing this, if any?
Bobby writes, I definitely relate most to Nicholas, as the environment he finds himself in is drawn from the many different stereotypes I, being Bobby, encountered growing up in Florida, specifically the suburban sides of Tampa and then later Tallahassee. It's mostly very exaggerated here for comic effect, but I certainly empathize with feeling like the fish out of water in a town that's very conservative and can often feel socially and intellectually secluded from the rest of the world. In this regard, it was cathartic to poke fun at the stupidity of these types of characters in a way that was creative, humorous, and irreverent. I brainstormed this story with a writer friend of mine who encouraged me to be creative with the concept of Nick losing his book and the consequences of someone like Bill wreaking his own form of havoc. That friend also helped me flesh out Bill's side of the story more. For all intents and purposes, Bill is a walking stereotype, but there is an earnestness about him that reminds me of the more good-hearted Deep South folk I've met. So it was important to have that element as part of Bill's arc and Nicholas's character growth. And I think we'll get to this later. The idea of taking a character that, you know, at first blush is challenging for the audience to get on board with. It's always a challenge to get them on board and how we go about doing that, finding our way through characters and humanizing the what we view as the worst aspects of humanity. Such a feat when a writer is able to do that. I'll just say, because I raised my hand and voiced the main character for this one, it was a lot of fun playing Nicholas. Bobby, thank you for writing the character. I think you could almost invert the perspective on Bill and say the same thing about Nicholas from so many other people's point of view. And how the two come together is a really nice marriage of friendship. Bobby, thank you again. Question two, Chase?
Question two is, when Nicholas is contemplating the implications of having lost his book, there's an assertion that someone would have to know what to do with the book to be able to unleash any real harm. He figures that nobody else at the resort is the practicing mystic, assuming they're all dumb hillbillies. Is this the first time that Nicholas underestimates Bill, or does Bill simply get lucky?
He got very lucky. We learned through the course of the story that Bill is a well-meaning guy who's just down on his luck and a bit of a screw-up, but we never really intended to have Nick underestimate his intellectual capacity. If we wanted Nicholas to underestimate Bill, we'd have him brush off the chaos and ignore the potential dangers more. Plus, he wouldn't panic immediately once Bill's goofy antics get underway. I think that in the world of the story, most of the spells that Bill is casting are completely random ones that he isn't fully aware of due to his intense inebriation, with the exception of the pool full of liquor, which plays like a perverse fantasy. Bobby, thank you for your answers. Thank you for your writing, for your story, and thank you for participating. So we're going to move on now to Peyton. Peyton wrote, Enlighten Your Minds. Peyton, there are a number of themes at play in your story, but one that really shines through is the theme of faith, at least in our perspective. Not just faith in the religious spiritual sense, but also faith in other people, faith in strangers, really. It's a big leap for Manali to put her faith in Reese. I think any sane person would probably expedite their checkout from that resort, but Manali stays in it undeterred. Without meaning to make you sound political or put you on some soapbox, was there something about the human condition, maybe humanity at large, that you felt you were responding to by telling the story?
I think the message that I'm trying to share is that companionship and love and care can come from the most unexpected of places. I think that Manali is in a terrible situation. She is living in this very materialistic life with a boyfriend who clearly doesn't care for her. And she was literally sent away to be on an island alone at this moment when you're giving birth, when you want someone to be there for you in companionship. And even though Reese goes about it in a totally insane way, I think that Reese sees her in a way that no one else has before. Reese provides that care and companionship to Manali, and it means something to both of them. But they only got it by having faith in the goodness of people and trusting that companionship will come from someone that you might not expect, which is something that I've seen in my life. So I reflected it in these characters.
Well, I think it was such a beautiful relationship that they ultimately come to have. Certainly something that we can all relate to. These individuals who come into our lives have such a great impact at moments when we need it most, but maybe don't even realize it. To that end, where the story ends, Manali and Reese have created a bond that seems lasting. But knowing both will inevitably have to go home, what future do you imagine for them?
I have like two pitches for what I would see happening next. I think one is more hopeful in the tone of my first answer, and then one is more realistic. I would love if Manali left her materialistic lifestyle and this boyfriend who doesn't care for her and ran away with Reese, and they had this whole new sitcom kind of relationship in the US where they're like both raising their babies together and learning how to live these two lives together. I think that'd be a really fun way for it to turn out. This is funny because my first answer was so positive, but in a more realistic point of view, I think that it's really hard for people to leave behind the lives that they know and the relationships they know. And this is so embarrassing, but I just was watching Temptation Island. And on that show, they form these like loves that they think that they're going to bring back their normal lives. But a lot of times when you're on those shows, when you come back home, your lives just don't mesh. And I think that that's the reality for Manali and Reese. And so I think that in the most logical form of what would happen next, Manali would go back to her life, Reese would go back to her life, and nothing really have changed much. Even meaningful friendships don't always last forever.
Yeah, isn't that true? And I think something that I'm maybe just now realizing with this particular prompt, and resorts, they just have this magical nature, right? They're a place that's so removed from your normal everyday life that anything is really possible there. And the bonds that you make, a few of you have mentioned this, the show The White Lotus just captures so well that being removed from what's comfortable to you and opening yourself up to different opportunities, different experiences, different people, and how quickly we can create such strong bonds with people there. Thank you for those answers. It was very insightful.
Jacqueline, you're up. Jacqueline wrote Anthony John. The mystic in your story is such an interesting character to me. On one hand, he's an abusive false prophet. On the other hand, he's the only person who can give a voice to the actual mystic, who we learn is AJ, the dog. Of course, he robs AJ of the acclaim, the admiration, the dutifulness that's shown by the Islanders. Yet there's this inclination to feel empathetic towards him. How do you approach a morally misaligned or corrupt character like the Mystic and keep the audience not just from loathing him, but get us to feel sorry for him? In a broader sense, can you speak to the challenge as a writer to create a complicated character as such?
I think it's all about striking a balance with the tone. The use of humor, especially absurd humor, creates a lot of space for an audience to accept a more unsavory character. Like with something like Jim Carrey's The Grinch isn't trying to massacre Whoville. He's trying to ruin their Christmas. In my story, the idea is absurd. There's a clairvoyant poodle. The Mystic's outbursts are absurd. And in many ways, these characters like The Grinch and The Mystic, there's also a lot of sadness under the surface, which makes them a little more complex. I think there's an extent of cruelty that we wouldn't accept as an audience. If the Mystic had murdered the poodle, that might cross a line. He yells at the dog, but he doesn't starve him or leave him out in the cold. He's not unnecessarily cruel. Also, I think backstory is important. With the Mystic, he swept crumbs at a bagel factory and he got fired from this job. So in that sense, you might understand why he's not really willing to give up his position of power on this island. It means a lot to him. And there is something a little pathetic about him that perhaps gives us permission to feel for him and to identify with him.
Hey, it's such a great answer. And I think it's so impressive that you were able to do so much in 20 pages to get us to that point where we do empathize or feel sympathetic. We go through the rainbow of emotions, both with the Islanders, with AJ, with the Mystic. Kudos to you for being able to do that in such short form.
So final question for you is, let's pretend for a moment that this is a documentary and a talking poodle named AJ is accessible to you to commune with the spirits, but you only get one question. What would you ask?
I wouldn't necessarily need to communicate with the spirit, but it would be the opportunity of a lifetime to ask AJ to help me communicate with my cat, Mouse. If he could just leverage his clairvoyance and his status as an animal, maybe help me conduct some kind of relationship therapy with my cat, check in and see if there's anything he has to say. Maybe AJ can communicate from my perspective why Mouse has to go to the vet to clear up some confusion. Maybe he'd be less reticent to go. I could ask why he didn't like the stroller I bought him. There's this insurmountable language barrier between us, so I would pay a lot of money for AJ to help out with that.
I think I'd want to see a spinoff of this where it is AJ, Jacqueline, and Mouse, and what that adventure looks like. That love triangle would be really interesting. That's a really fun answer to that, and it's one that I'm going to be thinking about for a while, because where my head was at when we wrote that question was certainly not in the realm of being able to communicate with our animals, but I think that that is probably the perfect answer. Okay, John, last but not least, John wrote Last Resort. John, references to the eyes are recurring throughout your story. There's this initial idea that this is a darkness retreat and Mark just can't see, which he makes obvious to Asa. Then Mark's realization that he lost his eyes in the climax of this, and his remembering Louise's eyes. In a way, you're drawing attention to the fact that this story is being experienced in the same way Mark is experiencing his world. I wonder if that was a conscious effort on your part. And what did you find most challenging about shifting from the visual to audio medium as a writer? I know we've kind of touched on this, but I'm curious if you can go a little bit deeper. What are the advantages and disadvantages for the audience?
Yeah, thank you for noticing that. It was definitely a conscious choice to firmly ground us in the POV of Mark and his experience of the story. I wanted the medium of the audio drama to justify the story being told. And so by putting us in a darkness retreat, making the main character blind, and I wanted the listeners to be able to feel what he was feeling. So I thought that was the best use of that device. It was definitely a challenge to go from visual storytelling to audio storytelling. And so I just imagined, if you ever done a meditation app, they really guide you through things with their words. And so I just had to focus on that. And that really helped me tell the story by focusing on just the sounds. And I could forget the visuals a little bit and figure out a way to not only guide Mark, but guide the audience through the story. It was definitely challenging. I thought about sounds more than I usually do, but I think sound is a great storyteller in and of itself. It was fun to explore. I thought the eyes, you know, they're the windows to the soul. And in the story, you get to know Mark's soul as it's being encoded into the AI of the resort. It was a lot of fun to write.
Well, that's great. To that end, by the end of the episode, Mark makes this decision to fully upgrade and give his body over to the resort, essentially replacing Asa, or so I've assumed. If there were a debate about whether or not Asa was a human before he became Mark's automated assistant, which side do you come down on? And what is Asa's fate now that Mark has upgraded?
That's a great question. It's something that I hadn't really considered before. The story continues, I guess. I think Asa was probably a researcher or something that went into building the Cavern Darkness Resort. AI doesn't really have a voice without human beings, and I think that that voice was stolen from someone somewhere along the line as well, just as Mark, you know, his voice and identity is stolen in the end. Mark makes that decision to upgrade, to upload his consciousness and become one with the machine. He's a man that starts out obsessed with work, and that was part of his relationship problem. And then in the end, he is literally consumed by his work, by the machine in the end. It all kind of comes full circle.
Boy, haven't we all felt that way before, consumed by our work? Just based on what you said about having your voice stolen, I'm going to use that as like a small platform to just say that, again, we're so thankful to all of our voice actors. John, it was such a wonderful opportunity to work with you, Peyton, to work with you as not just writers, but voice actors as well, and our entire cast on this. We stand with all of our voice actors as AI is trying to intercept and steal their jobs. We'll continue to support independent artists like that. Thank you for telling a story that in a way sort of reflects what we're going through right now as creatives. Do you think you could listen and read your story as a cautionary tale? Well, thank you all for these incredible answers. Thank you all for your time again and your talent. We will never not be grateful to you. We've come to the moment where we reveal the winner of this season. Without further ado, Chase, would you like to do the honors?
All right. The winner of season 2 of Don't Write Me Off is John Martin.
Thank you so much. That's incredible. I'm so happy about that. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you to all of you. And as a reminder to the audience, John is responsible for the prompts for season 3. So if you do stick around and you absolutely hate them, blame him. But John, congratulations. Congratulations to all of you. Hopefully this experience was fruitful for everyone. You all now have something that has been produced that you can share with people. And that's really what the heart of this project is. It's just us being able to work with you all, work with up and coming talent, really give you a playground to do with it what you will. One final question for each of you before we go. We'd love to know what's on the horizon for you creatively. What are you working on next, or what are you thinking about working on?
I'm working in marketing, working on taglines, posters, which is fun. Working on a script, dark comedy, half-hour pilot. Working on that, hoping to finish that this year. We'll see what comes after that. Can I also take a moment to thank you, Cole and Chase, for this opportunity? It was really great to be a part of. And I also want to thank my cast, Anthony and Eric. Yeah, everyone who worked on this episode and this season. It was just such a pleasure to be a part of.
Thank you. Peyton, what do you have for us? What's on the horizon?
Well, right now, I'm the showrunner's assistant on this new Apple show called Lucky that's going to come out next year. It's been a really awesome experience and really fun to contribute creatively on set and in the writer's room now when we're like getting into post. So I'll be on that until December, which is really exciting. In my personal creative journey, I am working on a new 1 hour. And I have an animated half hour that is really close to me that I'm working with an animator to make a proof of concept of. So that's really exciting. I haven't gotten to self-produce anything in a while. So it's really fun to work on that.
That's incredible. Let us know when that's available, if at all. Jacqueline, how about you? What's going on in your world?
So I stepped away from the film industry and I'm currently working on getting a master's in mental health counseling. So that's really been my focus. I devoted so much time and identify so much with being a writer, so I would like to continue working on creative projects. I'm hoping to focus more on maybe playwriting or fiction writing. So I have some ideas going, but school has just been a little intense.
Yeah. Do you see a world in which your previous work ties into what you're studying now, or you use storytelling in some way?
There are these books written by famous psychiatrists and psychologists that have been really inspiring to me that ultimately made me want to go into this field, where they detailed their experiences with different clients, taking you through the journey. Sometimes they're really funny. Sometimes they make you cry. A very famous one is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone by Lori Gottlieb. Mm-hmm. So one day, if I've accumulated a bunch of interesting stories about clients, I would definitely consider writing one of those books.
I hope you do, and we look forward to it. Emma, we'll kick it over to you.
I had a baby 4 months ago, but right now I'm the script coordinator at Ted Lasso season 4. Other than that, I have a multicam I finished late last year that, now that the industry's kind of coming back up, I have a couple of generals lined up, hoping to pitch that once the room goes to England for shooting.
That's great. And for those who don't know, who are listening, can you just briefly explain what a general is?
A general meeting is kind of like a networking meeting where you meet producers, people from a studio or a network who might want to collaborate or work with you in the future. My manager is sending that script to people and then they're meeting with me and we're kind of talking about that and like what projects they have going on that I might be a good fit for staffing, and then possibly like other projects that I'm working on.
Well, that's fantastic. And we wish you the best with those. And we hope to see one of your shows on TV very soon. Amber, what's on the horizon for you?
I am going to be adapting one of my short films into a feature. So I'm getting ready to dive into writing the script for that. Still in the outline phase, but getting pretty close. It's a short that did really well in festivals. And we thought there was more story to tell there that we could fit into the short. If you want to check it out, it's on Vimeo. It's called Snowball. And it's about a black actor who's tired of being typecast as like the thug and the gangster. So he shows up to an audition in whiteface. And then it takes on this life of its own. And it becomes the hottest new trend. And everybody starts doing whiteface. And he has to deal with the repercussions of that.
I love that. We'll definitely check it out. And if it's okay, we'd love to share that on our page as well. Well, thank you all again. Thank you, audience, for listening, for voting. Please follow us on socials, like, subscribe, all of that good stuff. Rate the show if possible so that other people can find the show, so that you can stay tuned for updates on season 3 of Don't Write Me Off. But John, we need those prompts. So get to thinking, man.
Excited to give you the prompts.
All right, everybody, let's stay in touch and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Thanks again for listening to the season 2 finale of Don't Write Me Off. If you like the show and want to support what we're doing, we got some pretty great merch that we think you'll like. Just head over to dwmopodcast.com and click the link at the top. Every purchase helps us keep telling more stories. And thank you so much for being a part of our journey. See you next time.
A Lucky Broadcasting production.